This is the Shanti Mantra or Shanti Path of the invocation at the beginning. Om Bhadram Karne Vishnuyama Devaha Bhadram Pashi Makshabir Yajatraha Sthirairangehi Tushtuam Sastanubhihi Vyasema Devahidam Yadayuhu Sustina Indra Vruddhasavaha Sustina Pusa Vishavedaha Sustina Starkshu Arishtanemihi Sustino Brihaspadir Dadhadu. Om peace, peace, peace. Om, O God, may we hear with our ears what is auspicious. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious. May we, while offering our praise to God with our bodies, strong of limbs, enjoy the life which the God has pleased to grant us. May the different deities like Indra of fame be well disposed towards us. May the all-knowing Pusha, the sun, be propitious to all of us. May Garuda, the vanquisher of the miseries, be pleased with us. May Brihaspati, the supreme guru, grant us all prosperity. This is the formal invocation to Mandukya Upanishad. And last time, before the summer recess began, we were dealing with the seventh mantra of these Upanishads, where the Upanishad gave a detailed exposition of the Supreme Reality. When we say detailed exposition, you should understand the Upanishad tells us that the reality, the Supreme Reality, is a matter of our innate experience, consciousness. It is not something that we can explain, define, describe. It is indescribable, inexplicable. It's beyond definition. It can only be explained by explaining what it is not. So it is beyond all the tools of epistemology. Perception, inference, comparison, verbal testimony, presumption, or negation, or absence. That is, pratyaksha, anumana, upamana, sabda, arthapatti, anubalabdhi. These are the six tools accepted in Advaita Vedanta. None of these tools of epistemology can explain or define the Supreme Reality because it is beyond explanation. Then what is the relevance of all this? The whole purpose of study of the Shastras is to convince you that reality is a matter of inner experience. It is not a matter of explanation. So, the seventh mantra that we are dealing with explained that this Supreme Reality is not the seer of dream experiences or the experiencer of waking state experiences or the experiencer of deep sleep experiences. It is beyond all this. The mantra is this: na antapraknyam, na bhakishpraknyam, na ubhayadapraknyam, na prajnanaghanam, na praknyam, na apraknyam, adrishyam, avyavakaryam, agrahyam, alakshanam, achindyam, avyapadeshyam, ekatma pratyasaram, prapanchopashamam, shantam, shivam, chadurtham, manyande, sa atma, sa vijnyeha. This is the mantra that we are being dealing with. Now, the meaning is this: all that we experience, all that we know, is based on our experiences of the three states of existence: the waking, the dream, and deep sleep. The mantra says that the Supreme Reality is neither what we experience during waking, dream of deep sleep states, nor the experiencer of any of these three states. It is something which is beyond words, beyond definition, beyond attributes. It is the reality which we can understand if we follow the pursuit of who am I. When you go on denying everything, something is left out that you can't deny. The one who denies everything cannot deny himself. That is the subtle difference between the Mahayana Buddhism, that is Shunyavada, and Vedanta. In Mahayana Buddhism, the reality is defined as something indescribable, beyond words. It is one. But then it is defined as something which is fundamentally non-existent. Now the question arises, who is the one who realizes this reality? Who is this subject which experiences the supreme bliss of nirvana that you experience when you realize the emptiness, the voidness, or shunyata? Nagarjuna explains, he expounds his philosophy in Madhyamika Shastram or Madhyamika Karika, a famous book with this commentary on Chandrakirti. Shankara says, well, there is an eternal subject, an unchanging witness, an everlasting, unchanging, permanent subject, which remains without change. And that reality is our Atman, which is present in waking, dream, and deep sleep state. It never changes. And the moment we realize that we are that Atman, which is supreme existence, supreme consciousness, supreme knowledge, and supreme bliss, the moment we realize that we are not these bodies, we are not the one who lives in this world, who suffers and enjoys, who is tossed about by the mighty current of our actions and also our temptations and our tendencies. We are the everlasting, the supreme witness, which is of the state of supreme bliss. All that comes and goes, all the empirical experiences are changing. But the experiencer, the seer, never changes. The subject remains eternal. This is the thesis of Advaita. I have explained all this elaborately before we started this summary. Now, before we concluded the last session, we were dealing with a very interesting subject that is related to the seventh mantra. When do we realize the supreme truth? When do we realize that we are not these bodies? See, so long as we think this body is real, we have to think this world is real. And so long as we think this body is real, the world is real, we have to suffer agonies, miseries. So long as we go after ephemeral, empirical pleasures, we will have to accept the reality of misery, sadness, depression, anxiety, everything. We can never get beyond misery so long as we are searching for peace and happiness. Because these are two sides of the same coin. Vedanta tells you the supreme bliss, the supreme happiness is beyond both misery and also happiness. So the only way to enjoy eternal happiness is to stop searching for temporary happiness, to stop searching for empirical happiness. Gita, as I said earlier, sukham atyantikam yattat buddhigrahim atindriyam. Atyantikam sukham means eternal, everlasting happiness. Happiness is not a very happy translation of this word. It means blissfulness, where we feel something and we get a feeling that we have got something. Well, I have nothing more to search for. I have nothing more to ask for. I have nothing more to seek. That eternal satisfaction comes. It is called blissfulness. When did this come? In this connection, there is a very famous, celebrated verse in Shankaracharya's commentary. All these Upanishads, and also Gita and Brahma Sutra, all these great philosophical works, which are at least 7,000, 8,000 years old, they were made intelligible to all of us. They were given a philosophical interpretation by the great, maybe the greatest philosopher of Vedic times, Vedantic tradition, Adi Shankaracharya, who lived between 778 and 810, 32 years of his life. He gives a very graphic picturesque exposition of when this problem of worldliness comes to an end. I shall read the original Sanskrit commentary and then I shall give a detailed explanation. Of course, it is a commentary on the 16th Karika. Those of you who can study later, remember it is the Sanskrit commentary on the 16th Karika of Gaudapada. The Karika is this: Anadi Mayaya Supto Yada Jiva Prabuddhide Ajam Anidram Asvapnam Advaitam Buddhide Tada. This verse says, a Karika is a commentary in metrical form. A Bhashya is a commentary in prose form. Now, we are all sleeping. It is a kind of spiritual sleep. So long as we think that we are playing an active role in this world, so long as we are nothing other than just a living being which suffers and enjoys, which thinks that if we get pleasure and worldly enjoyments, there is nothing more to search for. So long as we are in this state, according to Vedanta, we are in a state of deep slumber, spiritual slumber. And this spiritual slumber is caused by, a technical word is a maya. This maya has got two characteristics. One, we are not able to understand the true nature of supreme reality. Second, and because of that, we take the wrong thing for the supreme reality. Agrahanam anyatha agrahanam. When suppose something is lying there, according to the traditional stock analogy, a piece of rope is lying there in a dimly lit room where there is not enough light, but you can see something lying there which apparently resembles the shape of a snake. Because there is not enough light, the true nature of the rope is concealed. You are not able to recognize, to understand that it is a piece of rope. So you think it is a snake. So the total non-comprehension of the supreme reality, that this, what is the real reality? The reality is that we are the supreme consciousness, which is all-pervading, which is immanent, it is present, it is an indweller in all living beings. It is the immanent reality in every living being. It is also omnipresent, it is all-pervading, it is also transcendent. We are not just human bodies which come and go. According to Vedanta, so long as we are in a state of ignorance of our real nature, we are born, we work, we suffer, and sometimes we have some temporary enjoyment and then we vanish. Again we are reborn. This cycle is going on. This is called kind of spiritual slumber. And this spiritual slumber is not a permanent state. It is not our true nature. Our true nature is the supreme reality. We are the all-pervading, the immanent, transcendental reality. Because we are not aware of these things, this supreme truth, we think we are this physical body, psychophysical mechanisms coming and going. This is a kind of spiritual slumber. And it is sometimes called eternal. Anadi means, not really eternal, anadi means that which doesn't have a cause. In reality, this state is unreal. Our true nature is that we are the supreme reality, supreme consciousness. That's the truth. But then we superimpose upon ourselves these wrong notions that we are these psychophysical mechanisms suffering and enjoying. This is a kind of superimposition. So in a way, it is not real. But then we understand that it is not the reality. Only when we really realize the reality, what's the reality? We are the supreme consciousness itself. So long as we don't realize this supreme truth, we mistake ourselves to be these physical bodies. So it doesn't have a cause. So it is called, it is uncaused. But the moment we wake up our eyes, we understand. Spiritually, when we wake up our eyes, we realize we are not the psychophysical mechanisms. We are the eternal supreme consciousness. So this Kariga, in a very graphic style, says all human beings who don't realize the supreme truth are in a state of deep slumber, deep sleep, in a spiritual sense. Because they are asleep, they are blind towards the supreme truth. They are in a state of total ignorance, and ignorance is the state of darkness. The moment they realize their true nature, suddenly they wake up their eyes. And suddenly they realize they are their supreme consciousness. Those of you who have not read the life of Ramana Maharshi, if you read, you will understand. Ramana Maharshi had an interesting experience. His father passed away. That is a terrible shock to him. And within about 6 weeks, he left his home. And he was pondering over the mystery of death. What really happened? He was very dear to his father. And he had an elder brother. Very happy family. One day father passes away. So suddenly he felt, he was there with me all these days. Suddenly he has gone somewhere. When he returned from the cremation ground, where the body was burned to ashes, he was suddenly, where was he and where is he right now? Body is gone. There is nothing beyond that. Then he felt, well, there is something beyond this. I must find out the truth behind this mystery. And he left his home. That's how he went to a place called Thiruvannamalai. And there he entered a mountain cave and did penance meditation there for long years. So he became a great saint. So that the reality dawned upon him. Now Shankaracharya, in a very graphic paragraph, compares the state of a person who is spiritually asleep. So he says, Yoyam samsari jivaha subhaya lakshanena tattva apradibodha rupena bijatmana anyatha grihana lakshanena cha anadikala pravrtena maya lakshanena Supnena mamayam pida putroyam napta kshetram pashavo ahameshram suami sukhi dukhi kshaidoham anena vartidascha anena itevam pragaran supnan sthanadivyevi pasyan suptaha. This is it. I shall explain in English. He's asleep. He's in a state of slumber. Then what is the state of the slumber? He thinks, I am his son, I am his daughter, I am his father, I have got this wealth, I have got a huge bank account, now I have lost money, Now I have got a lot of profit. All these are given here. I have plenty of cows. Cow was the currency in ancient times. So I have plenty of cows. Now I have lost. So he or she considers himself or herself to be just a tool, helpless tool, tossed about by the mighty currents of empirical experiences. Sometimes he is worried, sometimes he is jubilant. Now, this is the condition of deep spiritual slumber. Then what happens? Yada vedantartha tattva abhijnena paramakarunigena guruna nastyevam tum hedupalatmakaha nasyevam tum hedupalatmakaha kintu tattvamasyadi padibodhyamanaha tadaivam padibuddhide. Now, and as he is in a state of deep slumber, somebody gives him a kick. It's not a kick coming from an angry man, coming from a great teacher who, out of his mercy, out of his enlightenment, tells him, you are not this psychophysical mechanism. You are the supreme bliss, the supreme consciousness, which is all-pervading, which is omnipresent, which is immanent. It cannot be defined, but if at all you try to define, you have to say it is of the nature of supreme knowledge, supreme consciousness, and supreme bliss. Supreme bliss means it is not a state of satisfaction or happiness. Rather, that state contains the highest satisfaction, the highest happiness, but it goes beyond all this. Because ordinarily, when you say you are happy right now, it could mean that you are not happy till now, or everyone knows that state of happiness caused by any kind of temporary empirical gain will not be everlasting. Before you got that, you are unhappy. When you got that, then also you are unhappy because you are anxious to preserve it. It may be lost any moment. So even when you are in a state of so-called happiness, in reality, it is a state of unhappiness because we'll be anxious to always remain in that state of happiness, and it is never possible. And then after some time, what really caused this so-called happiness goes away. It vanishes. Then also we are returning to a state of unhappiness. So unhappiness is, in a spiritual sense of course, in a spiritual sense, unhappiness is a state, is the real state in which we live so long as we are satisfied with the empirical experiences. Now, the great commentator Shankaracharya says, sometimes a great teacher comes to you. Here, the statement is, a great teacher who is merciful, she says, Vedantartha Tattva Abhijnana, somebody who has really understood the true meaning of Vedanta. What's the true meaning? That true meaning is that we are not the psychophysical mechanisms. We are the supreme consciousness of supreme bliss, which is not subjected to birth and death, which is not conditioned by empirical experiences, either of happy or unhappy experiences. This is the reality. This is the true meaning of Vedanta. A teacher who has really grasped this truth, out of his mercy, he comes and tells you, Nasyevam tum hedu phalatmakaha. You are not just a helpless toy tossed about by the mighty currents of cause and effect. This is a literal translation. Because so long as we think ourselves to be these psychophysical mechanisms, we will be tossed about with the mighty currents of cause and effect, happiness and unhappiness.
us. The moment we realize that we are beyond all this of the nature of supreme bliss, then we can live in this world and we can watch all that happens around us and all that happens to us also. We can watch, we can be a witness without being a participant in the drama of human experience. It doesn't mean that we will not have to face problems. Problems will be there, but when we get ourselves equipped by this mighty weapon of Vedantic truth, we become strong enough to face all the problems of life. When we become stronger than the problem, then the problem appears to be insignificant. The problem appears to be a great unsurmountable dilemma or a crisis only when we are weak and problem is big. When the moment we become spiritually awakened by this Vedantic truth, by learning this Vedantic truth, that we are not the helpless toys tossed about by the mighty currents of happenings around us, then we become strong, then problems ceases to be a crisis. It will be something that we can easily get around. That's the meaning of this. And then how does this happen? The great commentator Shankaracharya says, katham means how does it happen? Nasmin bahya abhyantaram va janmadi bhava vikarosti ataha ajam sabahyabhyantara sarva bhava vikara varjidam ityarthaha. I'm reading fast. I don't want to explain this word by word, but I want you to listen how Shankaracharya gives is almost like a drama. See, we are going through this series of eternal lives and deaths. According to Vedanta, whatever we do with a feeling of with a conviction that we are doing this and that we are going to be the enjoyer of these, the results of these actions, we have to be born again and again. Because whatever we do with desire, with a strong attachment, leaves a tendency, an impression in the huge lake or reservoir of our mind. It remains there. If we do something good and or if we do something, any action that brings happiness, then we have a tendency to do it even when it is not necessary. If we do something and when it brings unhappiness, then we will have a tendency to avoid that action even if that action is essential, indispensable. So this tendency is always registered in our mind, which is called chittam, which is called antakarana. One department of the human mind where all impressions, all tendencies are stored. And then later, if not in this life, in next life, when we find ourselves in a set of circumstances and conditions where this tendency or impression can take the form of action, they connect together. The tendencies and impressions stored up in the mind and the external conditions will connect, will establish a link, and again we act accordingly. This is what really happens. And this goes on in endless cycle. Where does it end? You cannot ask the question, where does the cycle end? Because cycle has neither beginning, nor end, nor middle. But this cycle is not actually our true nature. The moment we realize that we are that eternal Atman, which is in Sanskrit called Atman, or the Self, or the Supreme Consciousness, which is immanent, which is everlasting, which has neither birth nor death, because it is not bound by the limitations of time. That moment, we come out of this cycle. The chains are broken, doubts vanish and we will be in a state of eternal bliss. Such liberated souls continue to live in this world. It's not that they run away or they live only in forests. They live in this world. The difference between such enlightened souls and other bound souls is this. Those enlightened souls live in this world, but they will never be bound. They will never be caught. They won't be trapped. They won't be enslaved by what the world presents to them. They can live in this world as witnesses. Even their own life will be a drama for them. So, and then when the teacher tells the helpless man or woman that you are really in your true nature, you are the supreme bliss, the supreme consciousness, that very moment the chain is broken. That's what happened to Ramana Maharshi. In fact, every attempt to even intellectually become acquainted with these ideas is ultimately profitable because it creates a strong tendency and impression in our mind. Later, these impressions and tendencies will ultimately become stronger and stronger, and our mind gets concentrated on the supreme truth. And then the great commentator continues, Yasmat janmadi karanabhudam nasmin vidya tamobijam nidra vidyade iti anidram anidram hi tatturiyam ataha eva sopnam tamin nimittat anyatha grahanasya yasmat cha anidram asopnam tasmat ajamadvedam turiyam atmanam buddhide tatha. This is the explanation. Now, the meaning is this. The moment the teacher tells you the truth, that very moment, we will have a spiritual awakening. Now, in Vedantic philosophy, in Vedantic philosophical tradition, there are two approaches explaining how this liberation actually takes place. Two different schools of thought, both based on the great Adi Shankaracharya's books. According to one school, a really earnest, sincere seeker can get this liberation if he listens to this supreme truth even once. It is called Sabda Aparokshavataha. It was highly highlighted in Sureshwaracharya, one of Shankaracharya's disciples, in his huge, voluminous works, Brihadaranyaka Vartikam, Bhashya Vartikam. I won't go into the details, highly technical books. I shall explain this, something very important. Suppose you have lost something which is precious to you. And remember, spiritual enlightenment is not getting anything new. It is actually a kind of homecoming. In reality, when you realize the supreme truth that you are not the helpless toy, tossed about by the mighty currents of destiny, when you realize that you are the supreme consciousness, supreme knowledge, and supreme bliss, you are not getting any new knowledge. You are rediscovering your true nature. You are actually rediscovering your true nature. It is not a new knowledge. Somehow you forgot, and now suddenly you remember. It may be in psychiatric cases, sometimes you know it happens. The people forget and it happens. The example is given by some commentators. Suppose you have got something very precious, which you somehow lost somewhere while walking through some streets in San Francisco. You know very well that it is something very important which you can't afford to lose. So you will be always, when you go in search of it, you will be always worried about whether you will be able to get it back or not, whether it will be lost or not. You won't think of anything else. Your whole mental energy, your whole power of concentration, what is called antakarana, means mind, the speculative faculty, the deciding faculty, which is buddhi, then the ego centric faculty, which is aham, and then the reservoir of memory. These are four compartments of the mental system according to Vedanta, antakarana it is called. In fact, your whole mind and intellect and thinking faculties all will be focused on the immediate need of getting back what you lost somewhere. You won't think of anything else when you go in search of it. And then suddenly you find it lying right in front of you in the street. Do you think you will mistake it for anything else? No. Because your whole mind was focused on that object. So the moment you found it lying there in the street, you immediately go and procure it. You will have no doubt whether it was the thing which you really lost, which you are actually searching for. Similarly, when a spiritual seeker becomes really earnest and sincere, he has left behind all other aspirations. He has no other alternative. He wants spiritual liberation. He has an intense desire for spiritual liberation. When he's imbued with this strong desire for spiritual liberation, and then when he gets instruction from a teacher, even when he reads this book, it will be the beginning of a new life for him. But it always depends upon the amount of intensity of the seeker. If you are going in search of something not very important, maybe a cheap pen or pencil, and then if it's lying there, you may not be sure whether it's your own pencil or something else, because it's very cheap. But if it is something very precious, and if you're always thinking about it and you're going in search of it, then you will not mistake. So, Vedantic philosophers say, those who are strongly desirous, those who had a strong desire to achieve spiritual enlightenment, for them, reading, listening, and contemplation itself will have a dramatic effect. Technically, it is called Shabda Aparokshavada, it is called. Now, for this, to achieve this immediate result, we need four important qualifications. And we should have reached the highest perfection in practicing these great spiritual virtues. One is, we must have a very strong sense of discerning faculty to discern between what is eternal and what is not eternal. Nitya anitya vastu viveka in Sanskrit we call it. Means what is real and what is unreal. If you are convinced that spiritual enlightenment is the only everlasting eternal reality, there is nothing else, then the first qualification is already there. Second qualification is, we must not have any desire for any kind of empirical worldly pleasure or enjoyment. Not only that, we should not even have a desire to go to heaven. In Vedantic tradition, even a desire to go to heaven is a stumbling block for the highest spiritual seeker. Because heaven is nothing but an extension of worldly pleasures. If you read any description of heaven in any religion you find, anywhere, whatever you can get in a 5-star hotel, 6-star hotel without paying rent, will be abundantly available in heaven. So heaven is nothing but an extension of worldly enjoyment. So Vedantic philosophers insist that one should never have any desire either for worldly enjoyment or for even heavenly enjoyment. The third qualification is, he should have a perfect sense of control of his internal and external life patterns. Samadhi, Sarka Sampatti. He should have a perfect sense of control. he should have a strong faith in the words of liberated souls, and so on. And then the fourth and very important qualification is, in Sanskrit is called mumukshutam. That means a strong determination and a strong desire for spiritual liberation. If these four qualifications have reached perfection in any spiritual seeker, even one reading or listening only once to these spiritual ideas will have a dramatic effect on any spiritual aspirant. That's how you can see when Swami Vivekananda came to America in 1893. If you read his life, you find innumerable people whom he had never met earlier and who had never heard about Vedanta became fully convinced of the truth of Vedantic philosophy, and he became great Vedantins themselves. When Ramana Maharshi was living somewhere in a cave, about 15,000 miles away from here, you find people from Europe and America went and met only once and they were convinced. So, see, it depends upon the intensity of our desire for spiritual enlightenment or liberation. Buddha also states in Dhammapada, he says, spiritual enlightenment or nirvana is in direct proportion. The ease with which nirvana is attained is in direct proportion to the intensity of the spiritual seeker, according to Buddha himself. So here, Shankaracharya says, if a spiritual seeker is fully convinced that there is nothing more for him to aspire for, then it is a matter of even listening once, reading once, he becomes immediately convinced that this is my path to spiritual liberation. This is for the highest spiritual seekers. Then according to another school, and that is for those who are all spiritual seekers, no doubt, but they are not as intensely desirous of liberation as the seeker that whom we described earlier. He is certainly a spiritual seeker. For those, they are not mediocre, but their intensity of their desire for liberation is not so strong. For them, they have to read, they have to listen, they have to continue reading, listening to these ideas. Then they have to think, they have to ponder over the meaning of these words. And in the midst of other activities, they should keep in touch with these ideas by reading, by listening. And slowly, their intense desire for liberation will become strong and they also will reach the ultimate goal. Now, in connection with this, there is another point that we have to remember. How do we look upon the world around us? How does an enlightened soul, enlightened spiritual seeker, look upon the world about him, around him? Here also there is a very famous passage in Shankaracharya's commentary. He takes the analogy of Indian rope trick, the famous analogy. This is, for those who are interested in history, if you read Alberoni's or Marco Polo's writings, travelogues, Marco Polo visited India maybe around 12th or 13th century. He's an Italian traveler. Alberoni came about 200 years earlier, perhaps, around a little earlier. They all refer to some kind of Indian rope trick, but it is mentioned in Shankaracharya's commentary. It is only an illustration, but it's important to understand this, the relevance of this. A magician or a juggler comes. He throws a rope into the air and he announces to people standing around him, look here, there's a war going on. An army from hell is coming to attack heaven. So these residents of heaven have sent me a request and I sent an SOS. I should go and help them in their fight against the army from hell that is invading heaven. This juggler says, that's the background. The Shankaracharya doesn't explain this background, but I should explain this background, and then only this interesting passage will be properly appreciated. So the juggler or magicians, he throws a rope into the air and then he apparently climbs the rope fully armed to the teeth with all weapons, and after some time dead bodies, broken necks and broken skulls are falling from all over, scattering, littering all over the field. People are seeing all this. And then ultimately he also falls down broken into pieces. So people get exclaimed, oh, this poor fellow is dead. And after some time, they look behind and they find somebody laughing. It is a magician who is standing nearby. So all these things are all just illusions. The analogy of the magician or the juggler. According to Vedanta, this world, this creation itself is just an illusion. This may be quite puzzling to many of us, I know very well. It doesn't, actually, strictly speaking, it doesn't mean that we do not experience this world. From the highest point of view, from the standpoint of an enlightened person who has realized that only Atman, the Supreme Consciousness, the Supreme Bliss, is the only reality. From his point of view, this empirical world is actually not real. Does it mean that it is non-existent? I have to explain a little more of what we mean by reality in Vedanta. In Vedanta, anything can be called real only if it satisfies three important criteria. One is, it should remain the same in all the three states of human experience: the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. You can very easily see, whatever we see in this world doesn't exist the same in the waking, dream and deep sleep states. In waking state, it takes 5 hours for you to reach New York from here. In dream, it may take just one split second. Everything takes place at the mental level. You don't walk, you don't travel by plane. You do, but only at the mental level, subtle level. Senses of action and senses of perception are not directly involved. So there is a difference between waking experience and dream experience. And in deep sleep, what we call sushupti in Vedanta, we come to know of a feeling that we had a deep sleep only when we wake up. When we are in a state of deep sleep, we don't see anything, we don't hear anything, we don't experience anything. We see, we hear, we experience only in waking state and dream state. In deep sleep state, we were experiencing a state of bliss. That is, in deep sleep, you find nothing exists, no objects, only subject exists. So to some extent, it is similar to the highest state of spiritual experience, which is called in Mandukya Upanishad, which is called Turiya state. So you have to remember these four stages. Waking state is called Jagrat state. Dream state is called Supna state. And deep sleep state is called Sushupti state. In waking state, the witness, the subject is called Vishwa. And in dream state, the subject is called Taijasa. And in deep sleep, the subject who experiences the joy of blissfulness is called Prajna. And the reality, the Atman, is called Turiya, which is present in all the three states, but which is beyond all the three states, which is not subject to any kind of experiences. Now, according to Vedanta, the experiences in dream, in deep sleep and waking state, they come and go, they change, so they are not real. Only in the ultimate Turiya state, when we realize that we are the Supreme Consciousness, the Atman, which is the immanent, the omnipresent, the all-pervading, the transcendental reality, that reality alone is eternal. It's not bound by any kind of limitation. And it is beyond time also. It should be beyond time. Because it should not be something which comes into being in the form of being born. And it should not vanish in the form of dying out. So, it is beyond the limitations of time. It is beyond the limitations of the three states of human experiences. And again, it is something which cannot be produced. Anything which comes into existence cannot be real, because before it was produced, it did not exist. And anything which is produced will naturally be destroyed. So, anything which comes into existence cannot be eternal by any process. So, anything to be called real with the capital letter R should satisfy all these conditions. It should remain the same in the past, present and future. It should remain the same in the waking, dream and deep sleep stages. And again, it should be beyond birth. It should be beyond death. You cannot say it exists, because if you say it exists, it means it did not exist earlier. Anything which exists, what do we mean by saying that it exists? It comes into existence. That's what we mean. Before that, it did not exist. So, it should be beyond time, beyond changes, and beyond the three states of dream, waking and deep sleep stage. Now, this world is not like that. Can we see the earth that we are living in? The mountains, the valleys, the bay, all these. Certainly they did not exist before the earth was created. Before Big Bang, maybe 13 billion years back, did not exist. After a few billion years, they will not exist the same way. They may exist, but differently. If the temperature goes to some 10,000 degrees centigrade, or maybe 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit, then the earth will not be what it is now. So, everything in this world is bound by the limitations in terms of time, in terms of experience, in terms of our own interaction. It cannot be real. So, that is what is meant by real in Vedanta. So, Vedanta says there is only one reality, which satisfies all these conditions. Vedanta calls it, by the technical Sanskrit term, it's called Atman, as the immanent principle, the principle which resides in all living beings, not only in all living beings, in all non-living beings also, are different, only they are not aware of it. So there is nothing in this world where it is not present. At the same time, it is all-pervading, it is transcendent. So, when we say, in Vedanta, you know, when we say that, as I said, you know, Nantaprakyam, Bahishprakyam, if you read that 7th verse of Mandukya Upanishad, you find it uses the path of negation, the method of negation to explain the reality, because the reality, the supreme spiritual reality, cannot be explained by saying that it is anything which can be explained, defined, and described is limited. Anything that you define has to be limited. The fact that it is beyond words, beyond limitation, beyond description, is the reason why it is explained as what it is not. Then the question arises, what is the status of this world? So Vedanta says, this world as world is unreal. Unreal means relative. Unreal here means relative. Illusion, maya, all these words should be understood not as non-existent, but as something relative. Relative implies the existence of something which is not relative, which is absolute. So everything is, everything that you explain, that you see, that you experience is relative. And it is maya. It is illusion. So the word illusion is the word used often for translating the word maya. It actually means relativity or relative. And Vedanta says there is only one reality which is not relative. And that reality is Supreme Consciousness, the Atman, as the immanent residing principle, present everywhere, in everything. And then, as the source of the universe, as the sustaining principle behind this universe, as the point where all this universe will get terminated, it is called Brahman. So they mean the same. At the micro level, we may call it Atman. At the macro level, we may call it Brahman. So when Vedanta says, this reality is not this, not this, not this, etc., what it means, that reality is not this relative phenomena. The valleys, the mountains, the rivers, all these are there in this world. But they, as valleys, mountains, and rivers, are relative. Behind them, there is the eternal, trans-empirical supreme reality. And that is called Brahman or Atman. That's the point we have to remember. So Vedantins often use this word in this way. Surupadrishtya Brahma eva nama rupadrishtya mithya. Mithya means the same as maya, here in this context at least. In reality, everything in this world is the supreme reality, consciousness, which is called in Mandukya Upanishad Turiya, which is present in waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state, but not confined or limited by these three states. They are present in all these three states. They are not limited by any of these states. So, I shall speak for a few more words. Then, today, for this is beginning of this new session, I can spend a few minutes with you to clarify some points, because the classes we started at the beginning of this year, so then we had a long interval. So perhaps to recapitulate, we may have some kind of discussion after some time. So the point I want to stress once more is this. This Turiya is a technical term used in Mandukya Upanishad, Mandukya Kariga, is nothing but the Atman, the Paramatman, and the Brahman itself. which in English may be called the immanent principle, the omnipresent principle, the transcendental principle, and also the supreme consciousness, the supreme knowledge, and the supreme bliss. Now we can have a short interaction. Any of you who would like to clarify some points may ask those questions. And then we generally don't have this session, question answer session every day, every Friday. But today, because we had a long interval, you can just, if you have anything that you want me to discuss further, you can ask. Yes. In fact, in reality, we are the Turiya itself. When we meditate upon ourselves as the supreme witness, the unchanging, everlasting, supreme subject or witness, which is present in deep sleep, dream, and waking state, but not confined to it, then it is a way to meditate. Yes, meditate in the heart. It is often stated that when we meditate on the higher regions for beginners, it may cause headache, dizziness, etc. So it's better to meditate the supreme reality as seated within ourselves. But ultimately, we feel we must also support that conviction that we are non-different from that supreme reality. The immanent principle, it is seated in our heart. The immanent principle. When we can look upon ourselves as the witness, it's in Sanskrit called Sakshi, it is called. The Sakshi Chaitanyam. In the Vedantic terminology, in Bhashya literature, it's called Sakshi Chaitanyam. At the eternal Sakshi. Sakshi means the eternal witness, which is supreme consciousness itself.
Swami, when trying to view this world as a divine play, so to speak, being the witness, I find that with some desires I can just stand back and view it as a witness, but some basic needs, such as to avoid pain, I struggle with sometimes. You know, I don't like it when I have a migraine headache or, you know, have to go a long time without going to the bathroom or something like that. And on a subtle level, sometimes that makes it hard for me to be a witness because I know that there are outcomes I'm wanting to avoid.
Well, in any spiritual teacher will tell you, if you feel migraine or headache, you might take a medicine, and then you should meditate yourself as something other than this body, which feels this medicine. It means this headache, all that. So this is often prescribed in many meditative techniques of Buddhist religion also. According to yoga, through sankalpa, through dharana, dhyana, samadhi, those who reach that stage, you can get rid of this. But for any spiritual seeker who is in the process of performing, undergoing this sadhana practices, you have to take medicine and then try to look upon yourself as the one which is not the body which suffered this pain and which needed a medicine. It's something beyond all this.
Is that
it? We had a long gap. That's why I was thinking, you know, we left some in the seventh mantra, please. Yes.
Sometimes if I am trying to be escape from something by trying to be just a witness and separating myself from the ideas of good and evil and, you know, black and white and such. Do you have any ideas?
Well, if you use a philosophical reasoning, you will understand anything which brings pain and pleasure. This black and white compartmentalization cannot be eternal. You are a seeker of the eternal, of the real. So if you look upon yourself as a seeker, then this problem won't affect you. See, if we are trying to look beyond the present, beyond the empirical, beyond the visible, beyond the changing, then we can go beyond compartmentalization of dividing things into black and white and all that. So I say, purpose of looking upon yourself as witness is based on this Mandukya tradition, you know, this Sakshi ideal, which comes in other religions also, Sakshi. Based on Mandukya, Turiya is a Sakshi. You know. Turiya is Atman, is Brahman. I shall give an example. For example, suppose you have a building with three rooms built one over the other. There are three states of human experience, the waking, the dream, and deep sleep. Now, if the room belongs to you, you are free to travel, to move from the ground floor, the second, first floor, and sorry, what we call first floor, second floor, third floor, all right. Let us see. You are free to move from first floor to second floor and third floor. But you don't belong to any of these rooms because the building belongs to you. You are not confined to any of these rooms. If you are confined to any of these rooms, then you won't be able to be present in all the three rooms. You had to be confined to one room only. So Turiya is the witness, is the Sakshi. It's called Sarva Sakshi, means the witness of everything. Witness of everything means without that Turiya, without that Atman, nothing happens in this world. You are able to walk because there is that divine principle present in you. Otherwise, you won't be able to walk. No one can walk unless that divine, that Chaitanya we call, is present in it. Nothing to walk. But the act of walking is only one particular manifestation of the presence of that divine principle manifesting through the media of your two legs and the volition of walking. That's all. It is the divine spirit which is present everywhere. But it itself is not involved in anything. Sakshi means it is aware, it is present, but it is not a participant. These are the implications in which the word Sakshi or witness is defined in Vedantic tradition. Bodhrutvat, Audasinitva. These are the two terms. Which means it should be aware of everything, but it should not be a part of it. That's the idea behind. So, if you can look upon yourself as the effulgent, the supreme consciousness, the self, the Atman, which is witness, without which nothing can work in this world, nothing can move in this world, but which itself is free from any entanglement. That's the idea. Yes.
So in this relative reality, as you were explaining, the trees, the rivers, the mountains are not real. What's behind them is real. So when Shankara takes that view, that whatever level we're experiencing, that is the truth at that level, how does he, I mean, what is the conception underlying that beyond the rivers, beyond the valleys? Is it,
Yes. Shankara's principle is this. All these empirical phenomena are unreal as superimpositions, real as Brahman, as abstractum behind all this. See, as I give the example, again you have to take the stock analogy of sarpa, Riju Sarpa Bhranti, means the snake and rope. I think most of you must be familiar, I need not repeat it, because every time some new commercial comes, some confusion. So now, there is a piece of rope lying in front of you. Four people have four different views with regard to what that object is. Shankara gives four vikalpas, superimpositions. Sarpa, Bhuchidra, Jaladhara, Danta. These are the four superimpositions. Vikalpas means superimpositions which Shankara uses. Now, in fact, the mantra comes here. Where does this snake go away when you realize it is rope? You thought it is snake. When you open the windows, you understood it is only a piece of rope. If somebody asked you, where did the snake vanish? The answer is, the snake did not go anywhere. In that means, does a snake exist there? The snake did not go anywhere because the snake did not exist. So we have nothing to deny in this world. What you mistook earlier to be the snake is now understood to be the rope. So when you look upon this world through the prism of name and form, nama and rupa, you have got valleys, mountains, rivers and so on. The moment you remove from your mind the idea of name and form, then you see only Brahman. As I said earlier, if you go to a goldsmith, you present to him different ornaments made of gold, but he may see only gold in those ornaments. According to him, the shape and the size, etc., are irrelevant. The quality, the amount of gold is relevant. So you may see a necklace as a necklace, but the goldsmith sees the necklace only as gold. So a liberated soul doesn't have to deny anything. He doesn't have to negate anything. What he does, where you saw the snake, he is seeing only the rope. The snake didn't come anywhere, anytime. Therefore, it doesn't go anywhere. That is in the famous, for your information, take that verse. It comes in the 17th verse, Prapanjo Idi Vidyeda. That mantra comes here. I shall take it up. Yes, take the 17th kariga you find here. Prapancho yadi vidyeda nivartedana samseyaka maya matram idam dvidam advidam paramarthataka. This is the sloka. Now, meaning is this. If the phenomenal world were to exist, it has to go. It doesn't go because it did not exist. So, from the paramarthika or absolutistic point of view, there is no distinction between the Vyavahariga and Pradibhasika. Pradibhasika, I shall explain. Paramarthika means the absolutist point of view. I mean from the point of view of an enlightened soul who has realized Brahman is only reality, Turiya is only reality. That is the absolutist point of view. Paramarthika point of view. Vyavahariga point of view means, Vivahara means common sense experience. Well, we, a normal man living this world, for him the world is real, the valley is real, everything related to worldly life is real. Pratibhasya means just thought. For example, this snake. Snake is only an idea. Snake is only an idea. It doesn't have physical existence there. Now, according to Shankaracharya, that is a view of Advaita. From the highest point of view, there is no distinction between the
common sense relative experience and just thought experiences. Because both are unreal. But this is only from the highest point of view. From a relative point of view, there is a difference between the relative and just thought currents. The relative means, I shall explain this in the context of this stock analogy. It will make you clear. In this analogy, rajusapabhranti means a piece of rope mistaken as snake. Well, this rope is a relative entity related to relative world. It is a vyavahari entity. Snake is only a thought. Snake did not exist, but rope does exist. You cannot say the rope doesn't exist. The rope is part of the world, part of our empirical experience. So long as we have the experience of empirical reality, the relative reality, the rope is real. But snake, it is only a thought. The moment you open the windows, the snake idea vanishes. So the moment you realize that it is only a piece of rope at the common sense experience, at the vyavaharika level, you realize that the snake really did not exist. It is only a thought. Now, from the highest absolutist point of view, from paramarthika point of view, when you realize this rope also is unreal. Because the rope can be burned and it becomes something else. You know. Rope came into existence yesterday and it vanishes in 5 minutes. If you set fire to it, it will go away. So it's only relative. Then what's the difference between the rope and the snake? From the highest Turiya point of view, there is no difference. Both are unreal. So long as unreality is concerned, the unreality of the rope and unreality of the snake idea are the same. But that is only from the highest absolutistic point of view. From a relative point of view, from the empirical point of view, there is a difference between rope and snake idea. Snake cannot bite. It is only an idea. But rope can, you can use it for tying something. So this is, I hope it's clear. So from the highest absolutistic point of view, the unreality of the common sense experience, which we call vyavahariga, and unreality of something which exists only as a thought, is the same. Both are equally unreal. But that is only from the highest absolutist point of view. From a relative point of view, there is a difference between the snake idea and the rope. Similarly, from the Turiya point of view, there is no distinction between the experiences of dream and waking state. But from the waking state point of view, there is a difference between dream and waking state. That's all. If you look at it from relative point of view, there is a difference. But highest point of view, Turiya is only reality. So the unreality of both the snake idea and the rope, the relative existing rope, the unreality is the same. That's the idea. I see it's clear. So now we will, I hope, so understand. So we will continue. We will have class next Friday. We will have class the same time. So welcome all of you and welcome back after the summer recess. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Darsha. Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.